Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful, I'd like to welcome you, dear viewers, to another in our series, Studies in Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be on each and every one of you. We continue to look at our module on fiqh. And this segment is perhaps a bit technical and a bit detailed for some of our viewers, or for many of our viewers who haven't been following the program all along, because we're at the end of looking at law. And of course, law and legal issues generally will be complicated. It's not, the average person is not able to delve into the intricacies of law and be able to apply them. That's why they have lawyers, they hire lawyers, etc., etc. So, not wanting to make this very complicated for you, dear viewers. However, those who are following this program as a course of study, it is important that you do understand these particular issues. And these are the issues related to differences which have occurred among the different scholars, which have to do with the schools of Islamic law and where they differed and why they differed. And in the last program, we were looking at, the last point we're looking at had to do with the resolution of textual conflicts, where we have two authentic hadiths, two authentic statements of the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him. One of them has one implication, another one has another implication. Well, there appears to be a conflict. How do we resolve them? What do we actually do? And the example which was given was one in which the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, had said that one should not pray prayers, should not make any prayers after the formal prayer of Fajr until sunrise, or any prayers after the formal prayer of Asr, the afternoon prayer, until sunset. That was a general instruction. Then we also had another general instruction, in which the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, that said, whenever any one of you enters a mosque, he or she should not sit down until they make two units of prayer. So that a person coming into the mosque, you've come in, you're bringing the world with you. If you just sit down next to other people, you may start chatting about the world. So before sitting down in the mosque, make two units of prayer. Focus. Why are you here? Bring yourself in the house of worship. Focus on worshiping God. Okay. Now, what do we do with these two hadiths? Abu Hanifa, he understood that the general ruling was the hadith which said, whenever you enter a mosque, make two units of prayer before sitting down. That's the general ruling. Wherever you are. However, if it happens to be after the formal prayer of Fajr or Asr, before sunrise, before sunset, then don't pray. You can pray all the other times, whenever you enter a mosque, but not these times. So he looked at the second hadith as being general, and the first hadith as being specific. That was the opinion of Abu Hanifa. The other scholars, the other three major scholars, Imam Malik, Shafi'i, and Ahmed ibn Hanbal, they took the opposite view. They said, the general hadith is no prayer after Fajr and after Asr until the rising of the sun, the setting of the sun. That's the general hadith, in general, no prayer. Right? That we don't get up and do any informal prayer, prayer which just comes from ourselves, voluntary prayers, you know, general prayers. However, if there is a specific instruction prayer, then you pray after that time, Fajr, and after Asr. That's a specific instruction. If you have now entered a mosque at that time.
Right.
So they looked at the second hadith as being specific and the first hadith as being general. And naturally, they had, this was a difference of opinion. Practically speaking, what did it mean for the Hanafi person following the Hanafi school of law? Then if he enters a mosque and it is after the formal prayer has been done of Fajr, then he will sit down. If he is from the Shafi'i school or Hanbali or Maliki, he enters after formal prayers of Fajr or Asr, he will pray 2 units of prayer before sitting down. Of course, in terms of religion, I mean, it doesn't mean, you know, you have now sinned, you've done this, you've done that. No, it's a minor point, but it's just an example. Of course, this could be a bigger point where the conflicts are on other more critical issues. But I'm just giving a small example of how hadiths, because both of these hadiths are found in Bukhari and Muslim, the two most authentic sources of Islamic law. So, conflict in these two texts, how were they resolved? This is just an example of it. Well, in the end, we have to look to see, I mean, because this is an interpretation, isn't it? Which one is general, which one is specific? We have to look to see, what did the Prophet do? What did he and his companions do? How did they understand it? I mean, of course, most important, how did the Prophet himself understand it? What did he do? Well, we have authentic narrations that after the prayer of Fajr, a man got up to pray. And the Prophet asked him, "What are you doing?" Because remember, he said, no prayers after the obligatory prayer of Fajr until the rising of the sun. So when the man got up to pray, he asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "O Messenger of Allah, I missed the 2 recommended voluntary prayers before the obligatory prayers, the 2 sunnahs of Fajr. I missed them, so I'm doing them now." And he said, "Okay." He gave him the okay. So what are we seeing here? That though in general you're not allowed to get up and pray, meaning you don't get up to pray from yourself, but if you have something which was missed, there's a specific instruction about it, then you do it. And we know Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had said that if a person oversleeps a prayer or forgets a prayer, he should pray it whenever he remembers it. Whenever he remembers it, he should pray it. So, if it were that he overslept and he came to the mosque after the formal prayer has been prayed, he can still go and pray it. He goes ahead and he prays it. And that's known, accepted. So, it is where there is a reason, where there is a reason and instruction for that prayer, you go ahead and do it. But if there's no instruction or reason, it is just from yourself, you feel to make some prayers, then after Fajr, after Asr, you shouldn't. We also have the example that Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, on one occasion, after Salatul Asr, when he went back home, he started to make some units of prayer. So his wife asked him, "O Messenger of Allah, didn't you forbid us from praying after the compulsory prayers of Asr?" He said, "Yes, but my sunnah prayers, voluntary recommended prayers, after Dhuhr were missed because some people had come to me in the mosque and I missed the chance to do them. So I'm doing them now." So again, his practice has clarified that it is permissible after those times, as long as it is a prayer which was recommended to be done or instructed to be done. So the more correct position is that when a person enters the mosque, he should make 2 units of prayer before sitting down. I mean, this is such a strong recommendation that it is authentically reported that when the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, was giving the sermon of Jummah, the Friday sermon, and a man came in and sat down, people were coming in, he came in and sat down, nearer to the front or whatever,
And the Prophet stopped his sermon. In the middle of his sermon, he stopped and asked the man, did you make your 2 units of prayer before sitting down? And the man said, no. So he said, get up and do them quickly. So important that he is going to break his sermon and instruct the man, it means it's something that should be done. And unfortunately, it's something which is quite neglected in our times. People regularly come in the mosque, you'll see them on Fridays and other than Fridays, and just come in and sit down. Sit down with their friends, they start chatting and so on. What are they chatting about? About Allah? About the Quran? About Islam? Or just chatting about family, dunya, work, money, investments? You know, this is the danger of not praying before sitting to put oneself in the correct frame of mind. So the benefits of being in the mosque are lost. Anyway, we also have the third major area in which differences arose. And this had to do with some of the principles which were accepted by some of the scholars were not accepted by others. For example, we mentioned the four basic sources of Islamic law: the Quran, the Sunnah, Ijma, and Qiyas. We talked about it in general, that this was a generally accepted area. Now, Ijma was a particular point. Ijma, the consensus of opinion of the Sahaba, scholars, Sahaba. In the case of Imam Ahmed, he did not accept Ijma after the Sahaba as evidence. The principle of Ijma, the consensus of opinion of the Sahaba, he accepted. Fine. Ijma could take place amongst them. Why? Because it was well known that the leading the rulers of the Muslim state, the Khulafa Rashidun in those early years, they didn't allow the Sahaba to go traveling far from Mecca or Medina, because they wanted to keep them close to the centers in order that they would be able to pour out that storehouse of knowledge which they had, which could then be utilized for the governing of the Muslim state. So finding their consensus was quite easy. But now, after their time, where scholars now were scattered all over the realm, from Spain to India, from Turkey to Sudan, and all over the Muslim world, to try to establish ijma at that point, especially with communications being as they were, you know, back then, 1,000 years ago, Imam Ahmed said, whoever claims consensus is a liar. That was the position he took. He would not accept consensus after the time of the Sahaba. Oh, the other scholars, they accepted it. They accepted what they would call ijma sukuti, meaning that if nobody objected to this particular issue, then it was a unanimous non-objection. So that became the ijma. But for Ahmed, he didn't accept this because he said, well, because the fact that you don't have a recorded objection doesn't mean there was no objection. Because the issue may not have been raised in those areas. So, this was a point. We also had, as we spoke about before, Imam Malik's position about the custom of the people of Medina, where he would accept it as an evidence. The other scholars said, no, we will not accept it as evidence. We also had Abu Hanifa. He had a principle called istihsan. And Imam Malik had a similar principle called istislah. But these were rejected by Imam Shafi'i as being too independent of the Quran. Reasoning, where the implications of the Quran and Sunnah Ijma were left for what appeared to be the better choice. You know, because that's basically what istihsan means, istislah means, you know, you have a ruling, an implied ruling from the Quran or the Sunnah, and its implication appears to be not in the best interest of the people, because a text may have a clear ruling and it may have an implied ruling. Are all implied rulings applicable? This was the question. So the scholars took different positions. Some said, well, if it's implied, we accept it, as we accept the obvious ruling. Others said, we have to look at the implied ruling. Sometimes that implied ruling is beneficial to the society, we can accept it. Other times it's not beneficial. It may even be harmful to the society. You know, people can't function in this way according to it. So we won't accept it. And we'll go with something which is more applicable. This leaving aside the implied ruling and going to what is more applicable, this is what was referred to as istihsan and istislah. So, as we said, Abu Hanifa and Imam Malik accepted it, whereas Ash-Shafi'i, he rejected it. He would not accept it. Although he was himself obliged, in the end, to develop a principle which would allow for extracting other rulings where implied rulings didn't seem to be correct or very applicable. Imam Shafi'i, in terms of his own positions, he accepted the opinions of the Sahaba on legal matters, that their opinions should take precedence over all else. The opinion of the Sahabi. Whereas the other scholars, they said, well, they were human beings. They had opinions. We have opinions, etc. We will not, unless they're all not all, they're all gathered on an opinion, that's another situation. You know, they may have varied about that. But in general, they looked at their opinions as being opinions. They were not obliged to accept their opinions. Whereas Imam Shafi'i took the position that the opinions of the Sahaba should be given precedence over the opinions of all others, giving special status to the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet. May God's peace and blessing be upon him. And so we can see with these kind of differences, the scholars ended up with different rulings, took different positions. There is a fourth major area, which it's actually quite detailed and very difficult to go into in such a program. I'll just mention it. It's the area of qiyas itself, which is a reasoned area having to do with deduction of laws by analogy. And of course, how one sets the principles for that deduction varies from scholar to scholar. And so you find probably this is the area of the biggest differences among the scholars, deduction of laws by analogy. With that, dear viewers, we'd like to thank you for being with us in this segment of our program, Studies in Islam. And we hope that you continue to follow the program throughout the year. We are doing it based on a book which I've put together called The Foundation of Islamic Studies. This book is available at Dar al-Fatah Press in Sharjah. And this course is also being taught at Preston University in the Islamic Studies Department, which I set up a year ago. And it is known as Islamic Studies or Islamic Fundamentals 2. Anyway, we'd like to thank you for being with us, and we hope that you'll follow the program throughout the year. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.